First of all, let's talk about how you decided to run for office. What made you decide at this point to run for office?
Well, I guess what I want to say is that my investment in New Mexico is just really deeply rooted. And it dates back to the 1500s when my family first arrived. And my family has carried the torch of upholding justice for the people and their rights. I've also been involved in politics since my teens. And it first started with the New Mexico grads program, just testifying to help gain funding. And then over the last 9 years, I advocated for and believe deeply in my cause of supporting reforms that better the lives of children with special needs and their families. And I guess what I could really say is that I wasn't really looking to be a politician. This just happened because of my passion, because of the things that I believe in, because I believe in New Mexico, because I believe in the people.
Why now? Why did you feel that this was the time to speak out?
Well, it wasn't really a now thing. I actually was on the ballot in 2016, and I was kicked off the ballot. So I really didn't have the opportunity to really run in 2015. And so since 2015, I already knew. I knew then that I was going to run for office, and it didn't really change how I felt. I knew I was going to be running again by the next election.
Why do you think that the legislature is the answer? Why is that where you looked, at the state level and at the legislative level?
Well, I think as a citizen advocate, I understand what it's like to not be afforded the opportunity to be heard. And I understand how important it is to be able to stand up for New Mexicans. And I really want to be the voice for those who don't have a voice. And so I believe that the legislature needs more people like that.
I guess part of what I'm also asking is, what do you think the legislature can do or needs to do to solve the problems that you're concerned with? What's the remedy on the legislative level?
Well, currently, I don't think I'll ever stop pushing for Michael's Law, which is a law that I've been working on for many years. And I do believe that where I'm at right now, where I was able to this last session get some administrative code changes that we're working on, but I don't think that that's enough. And sometimes when your bills are in the hands of others, they don't have the same passion as you do for the same things that you believe in. And so for me, that is the why. I know that I have the passion and the drive and the energy to push hard for the things that I believe in. And I know that if I will do that for things I believe in, that I'll do the same thing for my community and the people of New Mexico.
I guess partly what I'm thinking is sometimes I think you can get more as an advocate than you can as a legislator. Now you feel that you need to take that extra step of becoming actually being in office.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Could you talk about Michael's Law and what it means?
Michael's Law, had it been passed, would have enhanced teacher and parent confidence and provided resources. It would have acknowledged the connection between trauma, mental health, and education. It would have streamlined the approaches when addressing interventions and referrals for children and youth. And it would have also removed silent referrals for juvenile justice probation.
Okay, explain to me what the silent referrals are.
Sometimes youth get in trouble, maybe at home or in our community, and often parents believe that they've situated the situation, maybe talking to the principal or the teacher or whomever in the community. And a lot of times, especially at school, a silent referral will be sent to juvenile probation, and the parent will get a surprise letter in the mail.
Oh, okay. So that means that a referral is sent without letting the parents know?
Correct.
At the time of the referral. I mean, eventually they find out.
Yes, ma'am. Well, sometimes you'll find out by mail.
Okay. And why is your involvement with this so strong? Why are you so involved?
This issue, it hits home for me. Michael Vaw is named after my son. And on a couple of occasions, we have those silent referrals. We experienced various injustices or various injustices or lack of understanding of a situation. And we realized, I think, during those processes, and my son has a disability, we realized during those processes that even the protections that are in place under disability are sometimes and in many cases ignored, and you will still end up with a referral, when really we know that that should not have happened. And so that's why it's important to me.
And could you explain for listeners who may not be familiar with the situation what a referral means? What does that entail?
Well, a referral could be a result of disruption to the educational process. An example might be a youth has a cell phone, the teacher says put it away or maybe give it to the teacher, and the student decides not to put it away or decides to not give it to the teacher, and the police may be called or a security officer may be called. And that then can result in a juvenile justice referral. Another example might be that a child may be getting abused at home and be experiencing behavioral difficulties at school. And that, depending on what happens with the child, could result in a referral to juvenile justice rather than a conversation with the principal to come to the understanding that there might be some trauma going on. And then, you know, proper referrals could be made and things like that.
Okay, so you mean being referred to the juvenile justice system?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And as you've been working on this and talking to people about it, what response do you get?
Well, we were able to get a few hearings, and I did get it out of one committee. But primarily, I think from the outside, we would get decent responses, but within the legislature, we seem to get stuck at every turn. Until this last year, which, I mean, we were able to get some rule changes that we're working on. And these are slow rule changes. This is stuff that's going to have to take place over time.
Okay, so everything is moving slowly.
Slowly, but it's moving.
Okay. Okay. You mentioned at the beginning that you have a long history, that your family is an historic family in New Mexico, and that other members of your family had been involved in the political system or legislative system?
In the New Mexico legislature, yes, ma'am.
Okay. So could you talk about that a little bit more, fill us in on your family?
It's kind of an amazing thing, right? So one of my great-grandfathers, Nicholas, was a state legislator. He represented Santa Ana Bernalillo District. And I found all of that through my genealogy. Mm. He's one of many. Another great-grandfather of mine was one of the founders of Albuquerque. Another family member of mine, through my Perea side, they would, during a time when you would be maybe physically abused, my family taught those that could not speak English how to speak English. And so we've always been about upholding justice. We've always been about the people. We've always been about their rights. And I think, as I said this before, I didn't look for this. I didn't really, I think no matter how much I have fought this, it's in my blood. It's in my DNA. And when I see that things need to be fixed or I see that something is wrong, this is where it's coming from. It's my DNA.
It must have been exciting to look back at genealogy, at your genealogy, and to discover these things in your past.
It's been a beautiful and amazing, amazing thing. I I couldn't even begin to tell you. I've had members who were even speakers of the House. I've even had family members who were speakers of the House. And it's just, as you said, it's a very emotional thing. Because I think when you think back to how the people lived in the early 1500s and you fast forward, you know, to 2020, they really fought hard and it was a struggle, you know, to just live, and the basic things that they fought for are still some of the very basic things that we fight for as a state now.
So that must be gratifying to you.
It is. It's very heartfelt, you know. It touches my heart in so many ways.
Well, tell me about, it's difficult to campaign in this kind of a situation. Tell me how that is working out for you.
Well, it is definitely challenging. I can definitely say, I feel like I'm being gypped by COVID. You know, I think I really wanted to, and I am enjoying it, but I was really very much looking forward to knocking on doors and shaking the people's hands of House District 17 and kissing babies and participating in parades. And I was just really looking forward to having that experience. And so that has been challenging, painful and challenging. But campaigning right now is really a lot of phone calls, text messaging, Facebooking, that sort of thing. So it's challenging. It's challenging, and especially with stay-at-home orders, you know, taking and putting a sign out is probably not the best way to do things, because it doesn't – it takes away from me being able to say I care about the people of New Mexico, right? Others are doing it, but it doesn't make it look like I'm caring about their health and well-being, and it would make it look like I'm encouraging them to drive around, and so that's definitely been a challenge. But I'm still here. So, and I'm very excited to be on the ballot and have an incredibly long last name, which is amazing, and it's an incredible honor. And to look at that ballot and see the first name and then see my name and go, why am I still reading? Because it's that long of a name.
Well, thank you for sharing your experiences and your thoughts with our listeners.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I think the only thing that I really wanted to add is that I really, truly hope that the voters will consider me and to know that I truly want to be a beacon of light and hope for all of them. That's it.
Well, that's a good way to end. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
It was good to talk to you.